It's really hard to recognize when you're in it. Because like you say, you see all the time, don't you, that badge of honor that comes with working long hours and kind of presenteeism. I've got to be here from 9 till at least 5, because if I'm not, then I'm not doing my job. And it's not necessarily the most productive use of time. And we tend not to hand out badges of honor for people who've maybe knocked off half an hour early to go and look after their well-being and come back the next morning more productive, more refreshed, got more done.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Burnt Chef Journal, a hospitality-specific podcast dedicated to challenging mental health stigma and conversations designed to inspire a new, healthier, happier, and more sustainable hospitality profession. The Burnt Chef Project is proudly sponsored by Lamb Weston, a leading provider of innovative, high-quality potato products created for chefs to help operators thrive both today and tomorrow. Working carefully with sustainably-minded farmers and growers, Lamb Weston provides potato solutions for every type of kitchen, from premium British chips and fries to potato shapes, wedges and mash. To find out more, head to lambweston.eu or search your partner in potatoes. We are live. So I am joined here today by Dr. Cyan Edwards. Thank you ever so much for joining me this morning.
That's okay. It's Sian.
That's a good start. That is a great start. You know, I struggle. Like Siobhan, it took me until I was in my mid-30s to be able to work out how to say Siobhan as well.
Don't worry about it. It's not the first time. I'm in Wales now. It's a Welsh name, but I grew up in England. So my name has been butchered many times before.
Oh God, that's not my intention. Not at all. Certainly not. I spell my name with a, well, I don't spell it. My parents chose it with a K, and sometimes they'll spell it with like 2 or 3 S's on the end. And I say, well, there's only one of me. Like there's no plural involved in my name on that front. But sorry, Sian, I do apologize.
So no, that's fine.
Thank you for correcting me. You are a doctor of psychologist?
Yes. So I did my PhD in performance psychology and mental health in performance settings, so specifically sport. But my background, I kind of came from a general psych background into kind of mental health clinical settings for a while, and then sort of veered sideways into sport. So I've had a little bit of a weird and wonky journey into psychology, but yeah, psychology is my bag. That's what I do. Funny.
That is amazing. And what was it that brought you into the world of psychology in the first place? What was it that spiked your curiosity into this as a profession?
Honestly, I think it was one of those subjects I enjoyed at school. And, you know, you go to university, you don't really know where life's going to take you, do you? So I sort of just picked it on a bit of a whim. But the more I do, the more I've been involved, the more I love it. People are fascinating. And the way we respond to the world around us is just... yeah, it really, really interests me. And you can apply it to so many different settings and work in so many different spaces and with so many fantastic people that, yeah, I really love it. I love it more and more each year, I think. Started off as a bit of a random decision and it's paid off for me. So I'm pleased I made it.
Good on you. There's a certain curiosity, isn't there? Like, I think that for me, I've mentioned it before, my curiosity was, well, I studied psychology at A-level.
Okay.
And we went through the Stanford experiment and I was just like, this is amazing. Like how can individuals who are so familiar with each other change in such a small time frame and then start to perform these roles that they've been given? It was amazing. I mean, I never took it on to university, but I guess look where we are now. So
that's just a great example, isn't it, of how we respond to the kind of power dynamics and the environments that we're thrown into. We're very much a creation of our circumstances.
Yes, which is something I think we can come on to later on, because I'm very interested. So for clarification, you're also the lead trainer at Platform Wellbeing as well, which we'd like to sort of explore and talk about, because you guys are doing some great work and massive impact as well. Like I think over 9,000 people helped in the last year.
I don't know the exact figures off the top of my head, but yeah, we're growing all the time as an organization and the work we do is really, really important. So it's nice to see those numbers creeping up.
Yeah, for sure. So we'll start with Platform Wellbeing and then I'll move more into the sports performance psychology side of things as well, because I think there are a lot of similarities with high performance industries and also sports. And we've had a few people on here, a doctor of sleep science who works with Olympians and a sports performance psychologist previously who works with Olympic gymnasts in Sweden. He sort of moved into Michelin star psychology performance now, which is quite interesting. So if you want an introduction, I'll introduce you to Joy. He's a really cool guy. And then obviously I'm keen to go back to the Stanford experiment as well. And just like, I think for me is exploring that psychology a little bit more, especially within perhaps back of house areas within hospitality, whereby things that would not seem normal from the outside have suddenly become normal within a very short period of time, and what we can do to try and tackle or to change that. But first and foremost, platform wellbeing. So for those who've never heard of it before or are curious about learning more, what can you tell me about Platform Wellbeing as an organization?
So Platform Wellbeing is a part of a kind of bigger charity called Platform. So Platform's a mental health charity. Kind of main aims and objectives of Platform is to change the narrative around mental health. So change the way we think about mental health, move away from the kind of medical model of what's wrong with you and start thinking more about social injustice, social determinants, and what's happened to you when we're thinking and talking about mental health. And the other thing is to try and get to a point where services work better for people that are using them. Because we know at the moment they can be frustrating and disjointed, and it can be really challenging for people that are involved in those services. So Platform is huge. Platform Wellbeing is one arm of the charity. And we do a lot of the training for services, but also for other organizations. So we do training and kind of workplace culture-based interventions for kind of housing sectors, public sectors, but also kind of corporate organizations where we talk about performance already, where performance is more of a driver and that brings its own challenges to a workplace. We're the training arm of the charity. We're the ones trying to, I guess, start that language change within organizations.
Okay, so I had quite a lengthy conversation last night with one of our stakeholders over dinner. We were talking about multi-site venues and the microcultures within those and how culture can be impacted by lack of time, lack of resource, and also perspectives of leaderships within those microcultures. And so I'm keen from a psychological point of view and from the work that you guys are doing, like what have been your sort of key learnings in high performance environments that are one, not conducive to a strong and healthy culture? And then moving on from that, like what have you found that have been the most profound impact in terms of changing those narratives?
When we think about performance environments, whatever kind of performance environment that is, it's very easy to get wrapped up in this kind of performance narrative where what you do and how you perform becomes the be-all and end-all. So what you tend to see is that the kind of narratives and values stem around sacrificing everything else for performance. It doesn't really matter what you do unless you're doing it to better than everyone else. So being the best rather than kind of mastery. It's about outcomes rather than process. And that kind of gets wrapped up into who we are. Our whole sense of self-worth and value becomes contingent on what we can do rather than who we are. I mean, in performance environments, there's an element of reality to that. Like we have to be able to perform if we want to stay in that environment. But the idea that the rest of your life has to be sacrificed and that you don't hold any value outside of that performance, it's not true. But it feels it when you're in that environment. And it's kind of that's what's kind of being said around you. That's how other people are acting around you. Culturally, you know, it's a really common narrative, isn't it? No pain, no gain. You see it in sports people all the time. Like, you want to go to the Olympics? Cool. You've got to shut down your social life. You've got to put your family on hold. You can't go to this wedding at the weekend because you've got to go to training. Like, that sacrifice and that all or nothing kind of drive is central, not just in microcultures, but actually kind of nationally, potentially even, well, not quite globally. People have different values across different cultures, but it's certainly in the Western world, very, very all or nothing.
It's interesting. There's two points that resonate with that, which is I think anyone who's listening to this will understand the within our sector, we have a badge of honor. You know, it's that I've done 7 days straight, I've done 9 days, or I've done AFDs, or, you know, I've only slept 4 hours and I'm fine after 4 hours sleep. I can do this. And there is that sort of ownership of that being your identity, right? And that being, yeah, I am impervious to anything other than just performing at my best. The other thing was that I've never heard of it before, and I'm going to butcher the name just as well as I did yours. So I do apologize again for that. But is it Do What Makes the Boat Go Faster? Is a book about Olympic rowers who committed to doing nothing but making things or doing less to make the boat go faster. So, for example, if they were on social media and they weren't training, they stopped that out. They didn't do to the pre-parade because that was a use of energy that they didn't require. So,
interesting.
So if people are in this sort of cycle, and if they are in this environment where they are locked into this performance type mindset, what are some of the, firstly, some of the key things that individuals can recognize in themselves from a perspective point of view? And then I guess, like, how do we start to tackle this?
It's really hard to recognize when you're in it. Because like you say, you see all the time, don't you, that badge of honor that comes with working long hours and presenteeism. I've got to be here from 9 till at least 5, because if I'm not, then I'm not doing my job. And it's not necessarily the most productive use of time. And we tend not to hand out badges of honor for people who've maybe knocked off half an hour early to go and look after their well-being and come back the next morning more productive, more refreshed, got more done. There's a focus almost on quantity, perhaps not over quality, but definitely on quantity of work that we can do. So I think just things like this, things like talking about it, highlighting it, is a really good way to get people to start thinking, and maybe get people to start thinking about their own practice. But it's hard to change at an individual level. It's the kind of thing that we need to create the conditions within the workplace to facilitate that, mm-hmm. to allow people to have time to look after themselves as well as their job, to have some flexibility, to be able to fail. If we're putting everything, all of our self-worth, all of our value on performance and being the best and looking at outcomes, failure can feel really threatening and feel really scary. And so it's almost like we don't have permission to fail, which is a huge stressor for anybody, because no one's perfect. We can all try as much as we want. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to fail at times. And actually, we need to, because that's how we learn. And having that permission to fail and know that you're not going to be judged for it, you're not going to be sacked because of it, that you can have useful conversations with your teams around failure, to reflect on it, to grow from it, is really important. And so if we're thinking about that, it's psychological safety, isn't it, that we need? It's things like having leaders who are compassionate, who can kind of recognize that failure is important and have empathy for people when things are difficult and give them that permission and validation that, yeah, things are hard. And if you've got to take some time or take a different strategy for a while, that's okay. I give you permission for that. But it's a huge job. It's a huge job to change a culture.
I often refer to it as, you know, looking after a starter for a sourdough, right? You have to feed it regularly. You have to make sure it's in the right environment. Otherwise, it dies. It stops working. It's no good to anyone. And one of our biggest challenges is when we talk about things like return on investment with business owners and leaders, when it comes down to cultural changes. And, you know, it's very difficult to try and convince certainly financial controllers and directors that there is a tremendous ROI on making sure that these things are implemented and structures are changed. But it takes time, you know, and I think, I don't know, how have you found that from a corporate? Because obviously you're not just one sector. How have you found that working with different industries in terms of, has it been a barrier to entry for you?
It can be, yeah. And it's really about setting up that work from the very start with this. We use the message that we move at the speed of trust, because actually if you want to create kind of psychologically safe environments, you have to have trust. I mean, that's trust with us. We're coming in as new people, but also trust within the organization, with peers, with managers, with employees. That takes time to build. But actually, once you've got that trust, then yeah, you do start to see the change. You do start to see kind of vulnerability and productive challenge within teams. You start to see reduced staff turnover because people aren't burning out, because people can fail and aren't living with this constant stress that they've got to be on the ball and firing on all cylinders all the time. You see improved staff well-being. You see more productivity and collaborations because those relationships are there, they're formed and they're open and they're honest. Nothing's hidden. And so there's no working around all of these unsaid pieces of information. Everything's on the table. So, you know, change does come, but it's hard. It's hard and it takes time. And there's a lot of reflection, a lot of learning. And it's a process we're going through still in Platform, changing the way we work and taking a relational approach where it's connection that's at the forefront, trying to create those safe spaces for our staff to be open, to be honest, to have trust. It's difficult. And we do get it wrong sometimes. We're still getting it wrong sometimes. But we're at a point now where we can talk about it and we can learn and we can name it and we can move on from it. I don't think we're ever going to say we've hit the nail on the head and we're there and we're the finished product. I don't think that ever happens. But it's certainly, for me, coming into Platform Wellbeing, it's a super refreshing way to work and place to be. And it feels safe. It feels like any one of us could mess something up and the rest of the team's got our back. We're not going to be criticized for it. Yeah, which is nice. It makes coming to work, even in busy times when there's tenders coming out of our ears left, right, and center, and different projects that are all kind of being juggled, it makes it a nice place to come to work, rather than something that you dread on a Sunday night, getting up for on a Monday morning.
Yeah, that's that sense of cohesion, right? That I think it's often it's one of the most underestimated or underrated elements, which is actually a lot of the things that you've spoken about don't cost a single penny other than a bit of time investment and a bit of forethought. And I think that, you know, when we start talking about reduction in presenteeism or, you know, how do we reduce turnover and increase retention, a lot of people think that there's a lot of money, there's a lot of fiscal responsibility here. Whereas in fact, actually, it is just about, as you say, being able for leaders to say, God, yeah, this is really tough. This is really tough. Great job. You didn't work out how we planned, but let's look at it together and see what we can do differently moving forward and make sure that, you know, it improves and it's all right, it's okay, like, let's go.
And it's about being brave enough to talk to people about kind of the rest of their lives as well. You know, we're all bringing our own baggage to a role, and sometimes the rest of our life gets on top of us a bit, and that's okay. It's about trying to create that understanding within teams that people are in different boats here and you don't have to know exactly what that's like.
Yeah.
But it's important to try and understand it and understand that not everyone is thinking the same as you, is feeling the same as you, and to have a bit of compassion for that and give people the opportunity to feel able to talk about that kind of stuff. Because we know if you can talk about how you're feeling and you can name your emotions and you can share that with someone, you can connect and you can have those feelings validated, it reduces the intensity of them. Yeah. We know that that connection helps us regulate ourselves. And if we can have that space within the workplace, then great. That's where we spend so much of our time. It's where so many of our, often our friends are, but like so many of the people we know are at work. And if we can feel safe there, it's got the potential to make a huge, huge difference to our well-being.
If you're enjoying this week's episode, consider heading over to our website and supporting our ongoing work in destigmatizing mental illness and creating a healthier, happier, and more sustainable industry by purchasing some of our branded merchandise. We have a whole range of t-shirts, hoodies, chef's jackets, well-being journals, plus a whole host more available on Worldwide Dispatch. All funds raised from sales of these items go towards free to access e-learning content, as well as providing free support systems and help for those who may be experiencing difficulty with their mental health.
For sure. And I think that's where peer supporting is like such a powerful mechanism, support mechanism, because you know, often enough, it's not always, certainly within our industry, it's not always your manager or your, you know, the leader that you go to, because unfortunately in our sector, there is still stigma around job security as a result of saying that you're feeling unwell or you're struggling with work. And again, from a legal point of view, I mean, it's completely illegal to fire someone if they come to you and say, I'm struggling with work and I've got mental health issues. But yet we still hear stories about it now. So there's a natural resistance. So by setting up something like a peer support network where you've got people who are at the same level as you, who are doing the same similar sort of job with you on a daily basis, but might have a little bit of lived experience, it allows that fostering of a healthy culture, open dialogue, without you fearing that it's going to have an impact on your role, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it helps us feel understood if we can talk to someone who's been in the same position or can provide that kind of empathy for us. Because yeah, there's a lot to be said for not feeling alone. And if that comes through peer support, then great. Yeah, let's do it.
Do you ever find with the work that we do, I mean, obviously you're very experienced, you've got a doctorate in this particular area, but do you still find it surprising, or I find it surprising that people still say, oh, I felt like I was alone. I thought I was the only one going through this, or I didn't want to seem weak. And you think that we're in quite a different time to the time we were 10 years ago. There's a lot of open dialogue. Is this still society and stigma talking, or is there actually something happening with our brains that actually makes us believe that we are the only ones, that we are unique in that respect, that we're struggling alone?
I think it's both. I think, yeah, the conversation is changing and people are talking more and more about kind of their own mental health experiences. But that's still a relatively new conversation. And I think to kind of undo the stigma that surrounded mental health for such a long time is a big job. We're our own worst enemies, we're our own biggest critics. It's easy to find compassion for somebody else, right? But it's always really difficult for us to find it for ourselves. So I think when it comes to talking about our own mental health, particularly that first time, it can be something we find quite shaming sometimes. It can be something we can feel quite embarrassed about, because yeah, there are still these connotations around weakness. And like you said, sometimes fear of being let go from a position, not feeling like we're strong enough to be able to continue. And obviously that's not true. It's not a weakness. It's none of that. But it can feel that way, because that is how it's been viewed for such a long time. And there's still the language and the, if we think about kind of the medicalization of mental health, we still talk about it as an illness, as a chemical imbalance, as if there's something wrong with us. Yeah. And that kind of language doesn't help with feeling shame. Thinking there's something wrong with us isn't a helpful position to be in.
No, and there's so much more information out there. I mean, there's the studies now, and yeah, there was a TED talk I saw a couple of years ago with a scientist who was x-raying brains with different people who had mental illness, and showing that firstly, there's a physical change. Your brain changes shape and shrinks. There's a physical impact of mental illness. But also, for me, one of the things that got me into this particular line of work was I studied the human givens model, which is less to do with you're unwell, take some medicine and it will help improve it, but actually going, what's the root cause of that illness? Where has that come from? What's driving that? And from what I understand of platform and platform wellbeing and the work that you do, you also look at a more pragmatic way of actually identifying potentially what it is that's causing those issues in the first place, rather than dealing with the signs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The relationship between the brain and our mental health is one that's disputed, and we can say there's brain changes in people who have got a diagnosis of whatever, XYZ, but our brains change in response to all sorts of things. You know, neuroplasticity is it's a positive thing. It's an asset. It's not a problem. So the fact that our brains change in some way when we've experienced a certain thing isn't necessarily a sign that there's something wrong with us. But yeah, the approach we take at Platform very much is there's so many things that we know influence mental health. We know that kind of adversity and poverty and discrimination and social inequality has a massive impact on physical health and mental health. And those are things that, why aren't we tackling those? Why are we looking at prescribing medication for short-term change when we could try and change the root cause? And yeah, like you say, get to the root of the problem. Where did this stem from? And how can we change that? And how can we prevent more people being in a position where actually their circumstances aren't conducive to good well-being? Because living in poverty, being discriminated against, all of those things, they don't put you in a position to thrive. Let's target those. Let's look at culture and connection and injustice.
It's a big, big topic of conversation in our sector with regards to, you know, perhaps changing the way that things have always historically been done. And, you know, if you are, we experience a lot of drug and alcohol use and various forms of things like self-harm within our sector. Never really has it been questioned before why. You know, it's just been the way that things are being done. But actually, when you start looking at the environments that people are in, and it's changing massively, and we're well on the road to a stronger industry over the next sort of 5-10 years, but there is a big misunderstanding of actually, like, your behaviors are usually driven by, yes, you've got childhood trauma, yes, you've got things going on at home, but also if you're working 80-hour weeks in hot environments with loud fans, etc., then it's likely that you're not going to be very, very well, because that's not, your body's under a tremendous amount of stress and your brain's under stress during those periods, right?
Absolutely. It's really easy, isn't it, to think about alcohol use, substance use as something quite irrational, because it causes so many problems and it seems to solve so few. But actually, it's serving a purpose. All behavior is it's a form of communication. It's a response to our circumstances. And actually, yeah, having a drink makes us feel better for a little while. And if we're trying to live in this position where we've got high stress and demands around us all the time, yeah, that's going to be really appealing. And, you know, if we've got no other way of managing that stress, then yeah, of course we're going to come to rely on a substance that does that for us. It makes perfect sense. And again, there's quite a lot of stigma around that. And that's not the way to deal with the problem. You don't shame someone out of an addiction. There's enough of that going on for that person already. I can assure you that. It's finding another way to help them regulate, to help deal with some of that kind of stress and pressure that they're under all the time. It's finding another way to alleviate that that's going to make the difference, not judging people for it, or brushing it under the carpet and pretending it doesn't happen. It's equally unhelpful.
Yeah, the more we do these sort of things in secret, the worse that it gets, really, because then you're having to keep up that emotional lie as well as manage the behavior in the first place, or at least try to. I was chatting to a chef last night who has replaced life of excess, perhaps not the healthiest of ways, with gym going regularly. And so he was saying, like, you know, when I go to the gym, I work out really, really hard to punish myself. And I was like, okay. He said, that's not healthy, is it? I said, well, I don't know. How do you feel afterwards? He says, I feel a lot better. I was like, okay. I mean, how's your body? It's like, I'm in the best shape of my life. I was like, okay. So yes, the primary driver might not necessarily always be, oh, I'm doing this because I know I should and I feel great. But the end result is a lot better than what it would be if you were to go down a different path and use, you know, different self coping mechanisms, right?
Absolutely. And people use different behaviors to cope in different ways. And you know what? If that's working for him at the moment, great. If we could get to a point where he doesn't feel like he needs to punish himself, even better. It's important not to judge a behavior as healthy or not, depending on whether it's a kind of typically healthy behavior, because we know that people can use exercise in unhealthy ways as well. And again, that's influenced a lot by the culture that we're in. If we're in a sports culture where exercise and body shape have really strong values and ideals centered around them, then actually we can use that as a way to try and fix ourselves. And obviously, that, you know, there is never going to be that perfect physique or that perfect level of fitness. So that can become problematic in itself if it becomes something that we're relying on to try and find some kind of value. People are complex, right? And we're all in different circumstances, have different values, part of different cultures. And so, yeah, the alcohol and the exercise may be serving the same purpose. And if one's working and one's not, then great. But let's dig down into that root cause and see if we can support that.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is important. Like you and I are both on the same page, where there's a more than one size fits all to this. And I think that's, from my experience, that's where people go, oh, this is too difficult. It's easier to do nothing than it is to do something. So, I mean, how, from your perspective, how have you found, what sort of strategies can you implement, or can individuals implement, if this seems like too big a subject to tackle, there's too many different personalities, cultures, etc., or it just seems like too much of a handful? What would you be able to suggest to those individuals to take that first step towards getting change?
You're right. It's something we come across all the time. It's, oh my gosh, there's so much to think about. It's too much and people become overwhelmed. So the work that we do at Platform Wellbeing, it's the reason we don't kind of do off-the-shelf packages. If we're looking at kind of organizational change and culture, a lot of our work is, firstly, let's get to grips with what's going on in this particular environment for this particular group of people. Let's explore that. We do a lot of reflection alongside kind of training around some of these topics, because it's one thing to tell somebody what psychological safety is and what empathy is and why that's important, and it's another to implement it. So taking time to talk about what you've tried, what worked, what didn't work, try and make sense of some of that, and then go again is really important. It's not something you can just learn and then do. It's a process. It's, okay, let's learn a bit. Let's try something. Let's talk about it. Let's try again. And that's why being so open and honest and vulnerable and able to fail is important, because that's how you make the difference. It is such a messy subject. People are so complex. Teams are even more complex. Organization and cultures even more so. That it's a process. It's something that takes time, and you're right. It's not a one size fits all. It's a, let's think about this specific bit of it for now. Work on that. Reflect on that. How does that fit into the bigger picture? Let's talk about it. Let's reflect on it, and do that work over a period of months, years.
Yeah, bite sized chunks, right? And making sure you're always evaluating, making sure that it's effective. So, one of the questions that we get asked a lot is that individuals have recognized that they are in an environment that isn't conducive to their overall health or well-being, that perhaps there is behaviors that are being exhibited within the environment that don't match their values, or are just generally, you know, bullying or whatever it might be. Or maybe it is like the rota management or the timing that they're working. Not being a manager of that organization, or not being a key decision maker, what is it that those individuals can do in those situations? What options do they have?
It's hard, isn't it, when you feel like you've got no power over the place that you're working and the position that you're in. I think, firstly, talking to somebody about how you're feeling, again, because we know finding that connection, finding that validation is useful in itself, even if it doesn't kind of solve any of the challenges. Just having that moment to connect can have a benefit emotionally for us. And I think it's being brave enough to stand by your values and challenge some of the work that doesn't feel right. And, you know, sometimes that's going to go well and sometimes that's not going to be heard. But it's worth having that conversation. But it's hard. It's hard if you're not in a position of power to make a change at an organizational level.
Yeah, it is challenging. I think from my personal experience, one thing I always used to do is I used to swallow discontent. So if I saw something or I heard something or experienced something I didn't agree with, I'd go, I'm not going to say anything. and I would, and it would sit and it would eat away, and it wouldn't just fester for an hour or so afterwards. It'd be something that I internalized and thought about for quite some time, and it actually had quite a big knock-on effect. And what I've learned as I've grown older and a little bit more experienced in this field is that actually, if something doesn't feel right, be curious about it, ask the questions, don't challenge it necessarily in an aggressive manner, but just say, this compromises my values. I would like to know, you know, a little bit more information as to why you feel that this particular action has been taken, or this particular way you're treating me is just. And that might open the door to that individual going, I never realized. Or yeah. It might, you know, it might hopefully try and create a bit of change. But by being able to voice that discontent, it's allowed for me personally not to have that knock-on effect for the next day or the next few hours, and to eat into my emotional well-being, basically.
Yeah, and absolutely right. If we don't talk about this stuff and we don't express our concerns, people aren't mind readers. Managers, leadership aren't mind readers. And, you know, it might be that someone is coming from a good place and just has no idea what the challenges are because they're not experiencing themselves, and they can't read people's minds. They can't predict what's going on for everyone else. So it's important to talk.
Yeah, for sure. So
important.
As you say, there's no golden pill. There's no hitting the nail on the head in order to be able to solve this. But what it does mean is, if anyone's inspired by this conversation, or you know, you feel that you want to learn more, then yeah, that's one more person who's creating a tidal wave, right? Creating a bow to be able to create longer term change overall. Before we sort of wrap up, is there any other things that you feel would be really relevant to our audience with the work that you do from a psychological point of view, or even from Platform Wellbeing and the work that you guys do there?
Yeah, I think the thing that we just, if I could wish for one thing or for something that people would take away from this, it's like you said, Chris, it's to be more curious about the people that you're working with and what's going on for them, and to not be scared to have conversations about things that are challenging, about feelings, about stresses at work, about all of that stuff, because being curious is the first step to opening that line of communication and that different way of thinking and building a more positive place for people to work.
Yeah, what a wonderful way to finish. I think as long as your intention is clear with your curiosity, I think that's the thing that scares people, right? It's like, if I ask a question about religion, about, you know, race, whatever it might be, about someone's health, then I might be seen as being rude or naive or whatever it might be. But actually, curiosity is fine, providing you do it in a way that's authentic, I guess. And
absolutely. Absolutely. If I've learned anything, it's that people don't mind if you get stuff wrong. As long as you're trying, as long as you want to do better and you want to get it right and you want to learn, then mistakes are okay. And if you say the wrong thing or you use the wrong language, that's okay. People will correct you and you grow. It's not as scary as it seems.
No. It's, and as you said at the very beginning, it's giving the people understanding that you're not always going to get it right, and it's going to take that muscle memory, that neuroplasticity is only going to build by making mistakes and being able to learn from those. So don't be afraid. Like, it's not the big bogeyman in the wardrobe. You know, you're not going to make it worse by asking someone a question. So Dr. Sean Edwards, thank you ever so much for joining me. If people wanted to find out more about Platform Wellbeing, where can they look you guys up?
Look at our website. We're on social media, Platform Wellbeing. Type Platform Wellbeing into Google, you'll find us. We're a double F, Platform with a double F, because we're in Wales. So as long as you remember the double F, you'll find us.
Thank you. And the work that you do, where is it based? Nationally, internationally, based in just regionally in Wales, or...?
Yeah, nationally. So a lot of our work is in Wales, but we've got projects over in England as well, and we're growing all the time. So yeah, very much a national beast now.
Good. Well, I mean, you guys are doing some tremendous work, and the impact is huge as well. So I'm very pleased to have you on, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Chris.
No worries.